The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. This week's interviewee, episode 132, is Jared Wade. Now, we'll be exploring a little bit about why Jared, a native of Maine, is here in Colombia, and basically as a freelance jack of all trades in the journalism arena, he's here. He's working, he's making a life of it as an expat in Bogota. So for those of you thinking of I don't like to say giving it all up, but for those of you thinking of starting afresh somewhere else, Jared is a perfectly good example of someone who you could look up to and learn from, because it's a fearless decision that, you know, to pack it all in elsewhere and come overseas and live. And of course, we can also be location independent individuals. So tune into this one and hear how it can be done, you know, living abroad, living overseas. So we'll be talking about all manner of subjects with Jared shortly, just after this short intro here. But what else can I say? Well, this is the week. This is the week which yields us March 23rd. Now, why is this date of any importance? Well, this is the very date, 6 months from the moment when President Juan Manuel Santos he was in Havana, but our president here in Colombia announced, while he was in a landmark historical meeting with Timochenko of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. So it was in Havana on the 23rd of September, and he said 6 months from now, we will have a peace accord signed with the FARC. Now, I've written about this, others have written about this, and it'll be written about and talked about until we're blue in the face, but the story is they will not be signing a peace accord on March 23rd. So that is Wednesday. It's an unfortunate reality, but 6 months was far too, it was premature, wasn't it? It was a premature announcement. And well, you know, maybe that got our hopes up. Maybe it's left us a little bit in the dark about what's going on. But both sides are right in this one. It's better to, you know, take the time, get it right, sign something that's worthwhile and can carry the water that's needed to be carried. This is a serious situation. So March 23rd. So what are we looking at? We're looking at probably a bilateral ceasefire announced on that day, on very, very soon. So, of course, I hope like me, that you guys are stuck to the news on that day, plugged in and paying attention to everything that's going on. But Colombia is at a crossroads. There is a new form of 21st century capitalism taking place. There is a new form of altruistic behavior being practiced out there. Colombia is ready for change. Now, these are newer generations coming forward, ready for change. The old guard has stayed put. So it's an interesting situation. But hopefully Colombia will take that next step forward. We'll hear of a peace accord signed, then it's a post-accord situation. And hopefully we'll have the ELN sidling up to the table too at some point. For those of you who don't know, the ELN are the second guerrilla group in Colombia. That's the National Liberation Army, or the Ejército Liberación Nacional. And they will be sidling up, hopefully, to the negotiating table, most probably in Ecuador. Well, that seems to be the rumored position, the rumored location. But anyway, so we'll be watching the news closely, as always. So this is episode 132. If you want to get in touch, you can do that through the Facebook page, Twitter handle, and of course, write to us directly at columbiacalling@gmail.com. Our website is columbiacallingradio.com, and there you can find further examples and links to previous interviewees. That's 132 episodes gone. All of them are on iTunes, on Stitcher, and of course you can subscribe so you never miss a show. I'm flattered to feel that there are 7,000 plus people downloading per week. So thank you again. My name's Richard McColl, signing off for the moment. This is Columbia Calling, and we'll be back with Jared Wade. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars, as they say, the Athens of South America, as some others say. But I'm here with a very special guest this week, Jared Wade, who's a native of Maine in the United States. He's a journalist here in Colombia. He's been here for 2 years. And he's doing a variety of things. Interesting things, but it's Maine via New York to Colombia. How did you end up here, Jared? Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll give you the brief story. I worked for a small business publication focusing on insurance in New York for a long time. And yeah, that wasn't my passion, oddly enough. So I actually went back to school. I got a master's in international relations and started focusing on Latin America. I hadn't really been here. I'd been to Mexico. I'd been to the Dominican Republic, but on vacation. So I'd always wanted to do a big trip and eventually saved up the money, got my stuff together and did. I started in Chile, went to Bolivia, Peru, all over, and wound up here, and that was my favorite place. You know, it was the best. And, you know, as a journalist, I think it is the most interesting country down here. You know, there's things going on in Argentina, and obviously Venezuela is another ball of wax, but Colombia's just very interesting to me, and I just love the culture, the people, everything, the natural beauty of the country. So around and trying to make a little bit of a go here.
That's good. And 2 years in, you're happy, everything's going well. You've got you have, as what I know is, you're a frequent writer for what's it called? The Fansided, the basketball website. I don't know anything about basketball. The Fansided, and you used to write for ESPN. You are the associate editor of the City Paper. Those of you who have been to Colombia or Bogota, and of course who listen to this podcast, will know that we had Richard Emblin on months and months and months and months and months ago. He is the, I guess, director of the City Paper, director and editor. So you're the associate editor, so you're up to your neck in that, and you're writing for other publications, freelancing, and so on. So it's going well. I mean, this is it. You're making a life here in Colombia.
It is, yeah. You know, I'd always wanted to be kind of just be a freelance writer in general, and New York, I'd probably be homeless if I tried that, the rent levels and stuff. And when I got to Bogota after being in Peru and Bolivia and stuff, obviously, it was, you know, it's not super cheap here, but it's a lot easier to make a living and can kind of have a lifestyle that I like while, you know, working from home, doing freelance stuff, doing little trips here.
So the problem is, you see, a freelance life is so, once you've got it right, you can never leave it again, because this you know, I've been freelance for far too long now. and I just think there's an impossibility of me going to work. I tried it. I lasted 12 days. 12 days. I got a good job too. But it was 12 days. Because, you know, answering to people was one thing. It's okay. I can do that. I've taken orders a lot. But, you know, to get it the 9 to 5 or here 8 till 7 or whatever it is here, because people get up strangely early to start work. But you're a freelancer, you know you don't work, you don't earn, but equally, you work it out, don't you? You work out how to manage the lifestyle.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you're just like, I'll be poor for a month and relax a little bit and learn how to cook, or, you know, start going to the gym better. And, you know, it is nice. I think it's about almost 3 years pushing now that I haven't had a full-time job, so.
Yeah, it's going to be very hard for you to go back if that ever happens. But anyway, welcome to this world, this enviable lifestyle world and stuff. And so, we live very close to one another, so, you know, we've run into one another on occasion. And we were at the Christmas party, the City Paper's Christmas party, which I believe went till 4 in the morning.
Went pretty late. Yeah, got a lot out of hand. Yeah.
I mean, being a father of a very young baby, I was out there by about 10. But I heard that it went to 4 in the morning, and all of Columbia's problems were solved on that balcony there.
We did it. Yeah. That's...
Well, I'm glad to hear that. No, but what I want, when we've got you on the show. Not only sharing your experiences of living as a foreigner here in Colombia and as a freelancer and so on and so forth, because this hopefully will inspire other people not only just to come to Colombia, but if they if they're up against it in the daily grind, let's say in New York or London or Paris or Berlin or wherever, you can do it. It can be done. We can go overseas and. I mean, you've made it happen. You're out here and you're happy. And recently, I say recently, within the last couple of months, you were sent out on assignment pretty much into the middle of nowhere, Colombia. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Very much.
You went out to Mitu, which is the capital of the department of Valpez. Valpez is a huge department, probably the least populated in Colombia, possibly. I mean, it would be up there, wouldn't it? Out of the 32 departments or states, Valpez is an Amazonian state, I guess.
It's funny because you tell people here are going to the Amazon, and they're like, they think the Amazonas, which is a state called the Amazonas here. But yeah, it's a different river branch, but it's the Amazon jungle.
Does the water there flow in and into the Orinoco, into Venezuela?
It does go down. It connects down to the proper Amazon River.
Okay.
It's the Rio Valpez.
Okay, well, that would make
sense. It's an interesting. It's a black kind of. In Manaus in Brazil, where the two rivers come together, the Rio Negro and the proper Amazon, and there's the differentiation in the colors. So this is one of the black style. I don't know the exact difference of the science, but it's pH, and there's a lot of silt in it and stuff. So
it's got to be something to do with this acidity in the water, right?
Something like that.
And that would contribute to the lack of mosquitoes.
Perhaps that's what we were just talking about. Obviously I was worried about Zika and chikungunya, so I brought my 100% deed, and I was just I'll put poison all over my body not to get sick, right?
Yeah,
I don't think I saw hardly any.
I would expect so. If it's got that same color, there has to be something similar there. Now, but how, first of all, to fly from Bogota to Mitu, I assume you're doing it with Satena, the state airline.
We actually, it was through Fontour, which is the government's tourism promotion agency.
Yeah.
I think it's part of Pro Colombia.
Yeah.
So they had a charter plane.
Okay.
It's a small little thing.
Like a prop plane to get out there.
Exactly.
How long is the flight?
Wasn't that bad, 2.5 hours, maybe a little longer.
Still a long way when you think of it of an internal flight. I mean, I know it's not United States distances or whatever, flying from one side to the other, but still a long way when you think
of it. Yeah, whenever you talk to Colombia, it is an hour, it's an hour and a half, it's an hour on every flight.
Yeah.
So Bogota's kind of central-ish.
I imagine, this is a place that holds a certain degree of, I would say that there's a certain degree of trepidation in the minds of Colombians because of what happened back in the day. And correct me on the date, I'm not entirely sure, but it was back in the 1990s when the FARC, so the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, took the town with several thousand guerrillas, I believe. They just ringed it and took the town. So it's the only time that the guerrilla forces have taken a departmental capital. Of course, it is different in that it's cut off. It's not, it doesn't have road access. It's only river and air access, really, is that it?
So,
I mean, it's out there. But it was.
There's cars there, but there's not a ton. It's mostly motorcycles.
Motorcycles.
Like that.
But I mean, do we think it's 1998?
It was 98, I believe, in November.
Yeah.
I want to say it was 1,200 soldiers came in, FARC guerrillas, and took it over. I think they held it for
a few days, wasn't it?
48 hours at least, maybe closer to 3 days before the state could get it together and retake it. But I mean, they killed, I believe, it was 30 military people, and then something like 11 civilians, and the people were executed, after getting taken. And
I mean,
Was it General Luis Mendieta?
Yeah, I think so.
He was one of the longest held captives. He got taken that day. I believe he just got released three or four years ago.
We're talking about 98, so 2008. We're talking about 16 years in captivity.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a long time. I think you're right, actually. I think he spent 14 years or so.
I say 12, 2012
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, I want to as well. And of course, there was John Pinchao, who was the famous guy who escaped, but he was. He was. Uh, he, He was captured in that as a policeman and held for, I don't know, five or six years, but he ended up being held with Ingrid Betancourt, and that's why his fame rose, because he was able to give feedback on how she was. And of course, this was a guy who didn't know how to swim, and he jumped into a river to escape and everything. I mean, talk about it, being chained by the neck. I guess when you're in that situation, anything to get out of there. But it was several years he's written a book, and now he's one of these people, one of the military who travels around the country to talk about these issues and so on. So, I mean, you were there in this city. I know it's a long time on, I'd say, but in terms of the conflict, but could you see or did you recognize anything that would have sort of dated back to that period?
I mean, it's hard to say. There were people who you know, our tour guides and people kind of were walking us around, our fixers were pointing out, you know, this building was taken, it was held, and this was one of the few buildings that wasn't taken and such things like that. And there was definitely like buildings that were kind of demolished.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rough to say, but just because of the level of development there, it's kind of hard to say exactly, you know, what may have been affected and not.
Frontier town in the best version of it. Right?
It is. I mean, it's the capital of a state here, department. But I mean, it's 14,000 people. I don't know if there's a building over two stories, you know, in the whole place.
And how many people will be in Valpez total, do we think?
I actually don't know. It can't be much more.
It wouldn't be more than 20,000, I don't think, really.
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of communities. So that was the reason they brought us there. They were trying to showcase. It's called the Apanere.
Uh-huh.
This was the fourth edition of it. And it's every 2 years. It's a festival in the indigenous communities.
Uh-huh.
And there were people who, came just... It's kind of a congress, I would say. All these different communities come together. They put on their traditional dress, and they do dancing and music and food and kind of sell their different wares, you know, or trade. It's an intercambio, cultural intercambio.
Mm-hmm.
But then they have, like, you know, political discussions about, you know, the needs of them. You know, a lot of it's environmental. A lot of it is how to develop in a way that holds on to their traditions. But I mean, if you're in Mitu, they need development there. So
sure.
It's one of those things. It's easy for a Westerner to come out and be like, oh, it's, you want to leave these people untouched and you don't want to mess with their cultures.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was a sign in the town, for instance, said it was celebrating the eradication of a recent tuberculosis outbreak.
Yeah.
And that had just happened like last year. So it's, you know, I mean, they need more medical stuff. They need some infrastructure.
But it's bizarre because again I can sort of picture it. I can picture this Apanare, right? Apanare, this festival coming together of these indigenous communities, like a tribal meeting almost.
Exactly.
But it's not a gimmick at all. It's not for tourism.
No. I mean that was kind of the funny part was when I get home and I'm trying to write about it, was kind of wondering why Fontour brought us.
Yeah.
And I don't, in a way they are trying to promote more tourism there.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, there's not a huge reason to go there for tourism. You know, if you want to see the Amazon, I mean, I would recommend going to Leticia.
Yeah.
There's no real tour companies. There's no one who's going to take you out for 4 days and, you know, do the sleep in a hammock thing and swim with the dolphins and those type of things. I mean, there are people there who would do it, I'm sure, but
sure.
It's not like, you know, formalized in as much.
But it's not we're not talking about an ecotourism outfit who know how to work it and got it set up. And
I mean, so we were there during their meetings. I mean, they were talking on the microphones about their things to the whole group, and then later doing their dancing. You know, I was probably the only gringo there actually, but you know, there was five or six other journalists from Bogota.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we just fell out of place.
Yeah.
You know, they were incredibly welcoming and they loved to have us there, and they shared all their coca and their fish stew and all their, you know, smoking cigarettes. Everyone was there and doing that stuff. So they were very welcoming, but it felt very out of place, and you were very much a fly on the wall watching them do it. And the most interesting part is they say it's the largest maloca on the whole Amazon, in Brazil and everywhere. It's a longhouse, essentially.
Yeah.
It's a wooden constructed, it was pushing half a soccer field long. I mean, it was a big building, and it's a thatch roof and
cool,
you know, painted and all, everything with the wares inside and
nice.
Different.
And about how many, did you remember how many sort of, let's say, indigenous people turned up for the...
There were hundreds. I don't have the exact number, but yeah, I mean...
And they might have come from, you know, from all around.
There were some who came 4 days in a boat.
Really?
In a lancha, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's something. I mean, this is when you think about it, 4 days on the boats along those rivers.
Yeah.
It's just quite exciting that there's still these unexplored parts of Colombia and the world as a whole. You know, there's still these places that really don't get affected, like, you know, that we think of in the tourism, mass tourism. But it is, we come back to this point, Fontour, you know, okay, so the government, let's say, promotion arm, travel arm, you know, they took you out there, but for what reason?
Well, so, getting back to that, I think essentially so that we would publicize it more. There was people from El Tiempo and RCN that were, you know, having the video. So, I, you know, more so than saying, hey, go to Valpez, go to Me Too, it was, this is how rich Colombian traditional indigenous communities are. Okay. There's so much heritage and culture here that you really don't even have a business going to see as a tourist, but it exists and it's very interesting. And then, you know, contrasting it with,
I think that's fair. You know, again, a realization that it exists out there. It's out there because, again, it's just the only other reason that we know about it. Well, is what we were talking about earlier. This is the FARC taking the town in 1998. I mean, really, that is why it's on the map, really, for most people.
I told several Colombians I was going there. I barely knew what it was before. I got offered the opportunity, and all I knew was in the Amazon. So I was like, I'll go. And then I'll figure out why later. But I told several people, and they were like, oh, is that in Putumayo? And, you know, which is another
country.
Exactly. You know, it's another jungle community, jungle area that not many people go to.
Phenomenal. But so interesting to hear about this. So really, you know, you're the first person I've ever met who's been to Me Too. So therefore, we're breaking new ground here on Columbia Calling. We're going to take a short break, though. We're talking to Jared Wade, who's a journalist originally from Maine, but living down here in Colombia. He's been down here for a couple of years, making a real go of things. And so we're just talking. It's a nice open conversation about what's going on. So we'll be right back after this short break. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Please don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. And yes, we're talking to Jared Wade here in Bogota. It's where he's based. Jared Wade, as I mentioned previously, is from Maine. He's the associate editor of the City Paper in Bogota. And we've been talking in this last segment, we've been talking about his recent trip to Me Too in the department of Valpez. So, I mean, right out there, right on the border with Venezuela, or is it Brazil?
Brazil.
I mean, I have to look at a map. You see, that's how big it is. I mean, that's how big that state is out there in the Brazil. So it gives you an idea of where it's located. And, you know, as I said, it's the only person I know to have been to Me Too and Valpez. Oh, actually, it's a lie, but you're the only person I know to have been who's not in the military. So there you go. And you know, but it's interesting. I mean, you think about it. You came down 2 and a bit years ago, and Colombia was already in its state of change. I mean, the things have been improving. Let's say 10 years ago, we wouldn't have been going to Valpez. Even when, you know, when I started out, I wouldn't have been going to Valpez. They didn't even let us go to Caño Cristales.
Right.
You know, that's it. When I went down to San Jose del Guaviare to do a story on the NUCAC, that was, you know, out of bounds as well. There was no, you know, I had to get permission from the military and permission from ICBF and permission from Action Social, and it all signed off. There was no chance that they were going to let me take public transport, bus transport down. I had to fly in and fly out and everything. I mean, all of these things have changed. I mean, things have changed, these boundaries of where we can go and what's safe and what's unsafe are all very different. And I mean, you're benefiting from this. This is a good thing.
Yeah, and a friend of mine from New York just came down. She was visiting for a week, and she's a little adventurous. She's lived in Africa herself stuff like that. But she ended up, before telling me, she booked a trip to El Choco.
Oh, yeah?
And that was the same thing. You know, even people here have not been, you know. And then I would love to go myself. But 10 years ago, I don't think I would have wanted to be there.
I love the Choco. Yeah, you know, when I was there for the first time in 2007, it was only a few weeks afterwards that the guys got kidnapped up in the Morromico, so near to near to Nuquí, near to that, you know.
Yep, that's still where she was, Nuquí.
All right, it's lovely there, though. I mean, it's really incredible. We're talking about nature in all of its glory, tumbling into the ocean there. It's very savage. But your friend, so she's off on a trip around Colombia now. She's been in Bogota.
No, she was just here for a week and a half and did that. But it's, you know, it just kind of goes to speak that, I mean, she was in New York She didn't know, she'd been to Latin America a little bit, but she didn't know anything about Colombia. And she just found an eco lodge in El Choco from a computer in New York and wound up there 2 weeks later. And
which is
just
what it's all about, isn't
yeah.
it? But you came back from Mitu, so out there in the middle of nowhere, without malaria, without dengue, without chikungunya, and without Zika.
I was shocked, yeah. There was very, very little mosquitoes.
There we go. You know. So, you know, even though you bathed yourself in 100% DEET and your children from here on in will be deformed, maybe. I don't know. That's probably out of line saying that. But the 100% DEET, you didn't get anything out there. There were no mosquitoes. And you know, well, this is a good thing. But I'm interested in this. So you wrote your piece for the City paper. You are the associate editor of this paper. How has it been working for a, let's say, an Anglophone newspaper here in Colombia? How's this going?
I like it a lot. I mean, I think coming down here, as I was saying, it's there's a lot going on. There's a lot of stories. And I personally used to be a business kind of writer a lot. So the economy has picked up. I mean, right after I kind of got here, it kind of started to go down with the peso and the exchange rate and the oil prices going down. But I mean, that was one of the biggest stories about mm-hmm. Colombia over the last 10 years. I mean, it was arguably the best large economy in Latin America, you know, growing and was outpacing Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela were just, you know, falling off the map. So it's nice to be able to write stories like that because mm-hmm. if I was just kind of stringing and writing for random publications in the United States, I think the only thing I'd be able to sell to them is drugs and violence.
Well, it's one of my lines of work is that, you know.
I mean, I understand that's why what people from Europe and the United States are more interested in, that's the history they know about Colombia, but I don't really want to worry about that only. Mm-hmm. It's important.
Yeah.
It's very important here, the peace process. I mean, I think this is going to happen the day after this comes out, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about ceasefires and other happenings in Cuba. So, I mean, it's the larger story here, but there's so many other stories. There's 50 million people here.
Yeah.
There's entrepreneurs. There's tech startups. I did one cover story a few months ago about a botanist, scientist, who had very prestigious work. He'd been talking at Harvard. He'd been going to Brazil and going to Kansas, and he'd been pitching this new method of measuring the amount of carbon that is captured mm-hmm. in Amazonian and just tropical forests.
Huh.
And essentially, you know, the UN panel on climate change, for instance, they use a specific metric
mm-hmm.
to, in this many hectares of tropical forest, there is this much carbon captured. And he actually went into these forests and was measuring them by, you know, science methods that I don't particularly understand. But I mean, he's an incredibly detailed thing. And the takeaway was that he was saying that their methods, their calculations were off by up to 40%.
Really?
And so what that would actually mean is that there's way more carbon being held in these forests. So they're much more valuable in a combating climate change way.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, every time we burn one down, which isn't as bad in Colombia, but in Brazil mm-hmm. and Indonesia,
mm-hmm.
this deforestation is just running rampant. And if his numbers are right, which I have no way to tell you if they are or not, scientists from Harvard can maybe vouch for him or not someday. But if he's right, I mean, then actually deforestation is contributing more to climate change
yeah.
and carbon emissions than cars and all the other stuff.
Actual sort of combustion
yeah.
motors.
I think currently the estimate's about 30% of emissions are due to deforestation. His is more putting it like over 50 or 50-ish.
He's a Colombian.
He's a Colombian guy, yeah. He went to the University Nacional and
it's kind of amazing, really.
It is.
And probably the story not known here by Colombians.
No. I mean, it takes me, you know, 2 minutes explaining it on a podcast to even explain why, let alone writing it. So it's a difficult story to get out there. But
sure.
That's what I'm saying. These things are happening in Colombia as well. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's a narco. Not everyone's in the guerrilla, you know.
We know that. And, you know, we've done quite a lot here on Colombia Calling to try and dispel that. We have talked about serious
of
things
course.
As well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you have to cover it. This, as I always say, this is justifiable reasons for these and unjustifiable reasons for them as well. But we had the guy on from the New Republic, you know, who had slammed narcos.
Yeah, listen to that one. That was good.
That was a good one. You know, I liked that because it's like we get so tired. You know, I do get so tired of this. Oh, are you watching? And why is it my friends in England think that I would be interested in watching it? I live here, you know. But anyway, that's another story. But as you say, you know, Richard Emblin, the director of the City paper, he set it up with that in mind, though, to unearth these stories exactly like the one of which you spoke just now. and of course, you know, good news stories, but not, and not always good news stories, but just, you know, good stories about Colombia, different stories, maybe sometimes highlighting something negative that could have, you know, could be happening that he, you know, he feels strongly about. He gets the final say. But it's important. It's important. And how long has, I mean, I forget now. Has the paper been going since 2008 or something? 2007?
I think it's 8 years. So yeah. Do the math. Yeah.
It is. I mean, you know, my hat goes off to him because in truth, these, let's say, Anglo newspapers have existed in almost every country at some point. But they disappear after a while. They do disappear. I mean, my dad, when he lived in Rio in the 1950s, there was the Rio de Janeiro Herald. You know, that certainly doesn't exist anymore. You know, I remember asking after, and people looked at me like as if I was mental.
And this is at a time when, you know, traditional newspapers in the United States are going out of business because of the internet. And then we still print. I mean, I think it's 15,000 a month.
15,000 a month is a, you know, I think you probably get a greater print run than some of the newspapers and the national newspapers. Yeah, but hopefully they're not listening to this anyway. You know, I blackball myself from them, you know, gradually burning every avenue for any future I might have here in Colombia. But it is interesting, and you know, with the flow of different people coming and spending time down here, you know, I'm not saying the ones who are sort of fly by night backpacker or just coming in as a couple for a couple of weeks. You know, you've got your people who maybe work here, or you know, there's an embassy wife or someone else who's just here for a couple of years, maybe with an NGO or something else. You know, they're all contributing. There was a particularly interesting story. You know, I would never have thought to have read a story about the tattoo artist. You know, I don't remember who did it, but yeah. I did see her at the Christmas party, and she was quite tattooed.
Sarah, yeah.
That's right. But that's the thing, isn't it? Very different stories, and this is a good thing.
Wrote another one about kind of like the Comic-Con festivals that go on here. Not exactly Comic-Con branch, but you know, those type of dress-up situations.
See,
and,
I didn't
know,
even know that they existed.
Same, yeah. I mean, I wrote another story last year about Bernie Silberwasser. He was the founder of the Bogota Beer Company.
Oh, right.
So I got to talk to him, and then there's a few other, there's Tres Corrileras in Medellin. Uh-huh. I talked to the owners there, and then there's a startup right in our neighborhood, actually, Statue Rota.
I love it.
It's amazing. It's the best beer in Colombia, in my opinion.
The problem is he keeps changing, doesn't it? He's a tinkerer, and he likes to keep changing beers. And fine, I do like that. I do like that he changes the beers, but I would also like, to, you know, like the house specials that would stay on offer, you know, like,
exactly.
Could you always have the pale ale, you know, or something, yeah. Rather than this week we've got Spitfire or something or other, and this week we've got this, you know. But the Statua Rota is great.
It's one of those things. I mean, I guess in the United States we take craft beer for granted now, but it's kind of new here. And then, you know, Bernie, the BBC, the Bogota Beer Company, is since 2002, I think, now. And that's kind of become, it's gone through the evolution of a business. Now it's pretty corporate at this point. It's still, I like their beer, but it's, you know, it's
they sold to someone else now.
Yes,
that's why we've got a different sort of brand. There's the original pub type places, and now they've got their bodegas as well.
Exactly,
where it's cheaper. So they're trying to get the student market in there as well, rather than have them sit around and on the steps in front of their universities drinking poker or what, you know, nursing a carton of aguardiente between six. You know, get them into this culture now. I've not been into one, though.
Yeah, there's one right. It's up in the hills a little bit above. Yeah. Probably too high for you, but...
it's up by the Plaza Portugal there, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right there,
yep.
Yeah.
It's right in my neighborhood, so...
It's a danger for you, then.
A little bit. I try to steer clear, but I do make an excuse, because sometimes, I don't know why, but Real Madrid isn't always on Claro.
Oh, really?
Not all the games, and that's my team with James.
Okay.
So sometimes I'm like, oh, it's a Champions League, it's a Sunday afternoon game. I have to go out of my house and watch it.
This is quite curious. I mean, you are... You know, this feathers quite nicely in. I mean, part of your income is of course, sports reporting on basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, you can do that remotely so long as you're watching every game.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, I focus on one team specifically, the Indiana Pacers, just in the middle of the United States for you European listeners and Colombian listeners.
I've been to Indiana.
Yeah. It's a nice little place. Yeah. But I write about the General League as well, but I had always done that from New York.
Yeah.
So it was funny. I have a lot of people asking me, how do you cover the Pacers from Columbia? And I'm like, well, I did it from New York. And, you know, they would play games in New York, so I'd get to go to them there. But I've only been in Indiana 3 or 4 times in my life. So.
but I mean, how many, I guess, you know, I don't know a lot about basketball. I do on occasion watch the playoffs and so on. And the Indiana Pacers, that's the... You know, Larry Bird team.
That's correct.
From the old days. And hang on a second. How many games do these guys play a week?
3 or 4. It's 82 game season over, I don't know.
So you've got plenty to report on.
For sure.
You've got plenty to report on. And you write this for the fansided.com, and people can find you best by Googling your name or do they already?
Yeah, fansided.com, Jared Wade.
Jared Wade.
Yeah, I'm around.
And you know, so but are you a fan of the Pacers itself?
No, I mean I was. That's kind of the long story of how this all happened, but I was just writing generally about the NBA. And then ESPN had an affiliate situation going on, so I started a blog about the Pacers for them.
Yeah.
And I'd always just been a fan. That's why they approached me, because they knew. But it is funny, the more you cover something, it wasn't even really an attempt necessarily to be objective. You just kind of get too close to it. And I'm 35 now, and I don't know. Like these kids are all 18, 25 years old. It's just a different relationship with fandom. Although I say that, but James is like my favorite soccer player, football player. So
but he's Colombian.
That's fine. You hold on to some of that fan stuff.
He's up for sale. That's all I understand.
I don't know. I'm new to football, so you'd know better. It's hard for me to trust any of these rumors. It seems they say everything.
The thing for me, you know, let's talk about this a little bit here. It's Colombian. It's a Colombian theme. We digressed a little bit there about the Indiana Pacers, but if we get Colombian theme, James Rodriguez. He's, you know, he wasn't the finished article when he went to Real Madrid. He was excellent. That's not, you know, he was well on his way to becoming properly world class. And he's, you know, he shows moments of absolute genius. Not least, you'll remember the goal against Uruguay in the World Cup, which was, you know, taken on his chest, swiveled, and almost without looking, you know, we're talking about almost 20 yards out, pretty much.
That's out of the box.
It was phenomenal. I mean, no, and of course, he won the Golden Boot, didn't he, as well?
Won the Golden Boot, and he won the pole. Polkus Award, the Goal of the Year Award.
But so, you know, he's pretty good. But I don't know why Real Madrid, I think they end up buying these players so that their rivals can't have them, because they don't develop the players, you know, they don't then nurture them. Cristiano Ronaldo is quite an easy one to say, you know, Sporting Lisbon, then Manchester United, which is where he was largely made, was Manchester United, then going on as the finished article. You know, all of the people who've gone too young to Real Madrid, and James is one of those, just look like they get a bit of the confidence knocked out of them, and because it's just too big a team. And I worry sometimes, you know, for the sake of the Colombian national team, I couldn't care less about either Barcelona or Real Madrid, but I just worry for the Colombian national team.
Yeah, it's a tough, I mean, he was actually very good in his first year. I think he was 17 goals, 16 assists, and he had several of those similar, not quite as nice as those Uruguay goals, but I mean, there was a saying that went around that James Rodriguez only scores gorgeous goals.
Yeah, yeah.
He had 3 or 4 of those, you know, just shots into the upper left corner from outside of the box.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know, he's gotten injured twice. He broke his foot last year, and then he tore a quad this year. And then he's had 3 coaches in a season and a half,
which isn't easy. You know, I don't rate Rafael Benitez. I just can't.
Rafa hated him.
Yeah,
he was not really.
He's a dead man walking from when he came in, anyway. And Zidane, the jury's out still. You know, he's a legend in his own time, but I wonder sometimes why playing legends go into coaching. You know, he could have lived happily on a reputation.
It's actually funny. They say in basketball that it can't really be done that well. Larry Bird is actually one of the few, and he did it for the Pacers, and he got them to the NBA Finals. But there's something that is a stereotype that you're a great player. You can't coach middling players because you just look at them and say, why aren't you me?
Fair enough.
Why would you make that mistake? Who would do that? So,
well, that's an interesting thing. I kind of think about that. So, are the best coaches kind of more? Were they more average players? I know that Spinier and Eriksson was a very, very average player. Was he really a great coach? You know.
Right.
So we got
Pep. Pep wasn't.
No, he wasn't. You know, and Jose Mourinho was like a translator.
Right.
So, we digress. Well, we wish James all the best for the rest of the season.
And there's some games, because this is topical. There's some games coming up. They have Bolivia and then Ecuador.
That's right.
So Ecuador and Barranquilla in the 28th, 29th.
Yeah,
like
soon,
that.
Soon. So that's why that's the opiate of the masses. Everyone will forget about the ruling on San Andres and the problems with Nicaragua, because that's it. We'll move on to football.
I think the Bolivia game, it's in Bolivia, but I think that's on the 24th.
Okay.
So you wonder how they set that date. The 23rd date.
The Nido del Condor up there at 3,200 meters in La Paz. I've been to some games up there. Is it?
I went to it, yeah.
It's just hard going.
I was winded walking up the stairs.
But talking about these important dates, you see, the 24th is an important date. Well, the 23rd, so the day, you know, well, that would be tomorrow when this comes out. The 23rd was the 6-month point announced by President Juan Manuel Santos back in September last year, when he had a historic meeting with Timochenko, the commander-in-chief of the FARC. They were there in Havana. I think that Juan Manuel Santos himself jumped the gun and got excited, as he is wont to do, and said in 6 months we'll have the peace accords with the FARC signed and signed off. At the moment, it doesn't look like, well, both sides have said it's not going to happen, but something symbolic will have to happen on the 23rd. So if you're listening to this podcast after the 23rd, you'll say, yes, it did happen. They were right. But if you're listening to it prior to that, I hope that you understand what we're talking about. Now, from my sources in various fields around around the country, they've said that, you know, it has been recognized that the date is now significant. Now we know the 23rd is the 23rd. While a final and lasting peace accord will not be signed, it's very likely that a bilateral ceasefire. That's what they say. I don't know how you sit there in a newspaper as well, you're reporting. What do you think about these things?
That's generally what I've heard, and it sounds as though they're going to try to make it somewhat official in the sense of having some sort of international body there. I mean, I know Obama's actually going to be in Cuba in the days leading up, so I'm sure they want, you know, some photo ops there and to get some support from him somehow on that. So, I mean, it's a little bit symbolic. The ceasefire has kind of been going on for a while, both sides. Nothing has happened in a long time. It seems like we'll get there, but again, that's why I was surprised when he said the date. I mean, 6 months was one thing to say, and then actually put the actual 6 months to the day. It's strange because it was tough to figure all that out.
You know, I reckon we're talking in sort of July, August time for a final thing, because we're in the last, you know, issue, and it's how to end the conflict, and that is very thorny. And there are, of course, all of the sort of other details that have been, and I open quotation marks here, and this is what they said in Cuba. They say when they can't come to an agreement on something, they put it in the freezer and they're coming back to it. And there are a lot of those, and these things need to be agreed, because nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So when these particularly difficult, let's say clauses into a peace agreement have been put to one side while they just continued negotiating. So, you know, you have to remember that there's a lot more than just how to end the conflict on the table. And I think, President Santos on some level and on some occasions has trouble containing himself. And I think that's particularly demonstrated by his ability to have negated the existence of the agrarian strikes of a couple of years ago. There are no agricultural strikes, and yet I'm looking out my window and watching thousands of people marching below. You know, so who is his chief of staff and his press, you know, a coordinator? They must be either not doing the right job or really kicking themselves. I don't know.
Yesterday was the first real mass protests in 2 years-ish, right? And those sounded pretty significant. I mean, the shut down places. I know several schools closed down and things like that.
Well, yeah, the students went out and a lot of the unions were out there and stuff. And of course, they're protesting the lack of the, you know, credible raise in the minimum wage and of course, inflation rates and prices for exportation. And I mean, they're protesting everything and they're within their rights to protest. And they were all downtown, kicking in shop windows, and which again happens usually on May Day. But these protests are going to set to continue, and that the very, very, very conservative hawk Fernando Londoño right. has been inciting crowds via his YouTube channel to march on April the 2nd against the president and against the peace process. Fernando Londoño was a minister in Uribe, former President Uribe's cabinet, and he was also almost killed in a bomb attempt a couple of years ago on the 70-something. And, you know, he and Jose Obdulio, you're going to have to look up these names, so he and Jose Obdulio more or less wrote the political theory for the Uribismo. Fernando Londoño makes the procurador, so the attorney general type person, look liberal. so he's getting, he's up there talking about the worry for Castro Chavismo in Colombia, and that we'll be living on scraps, and no country has ever come good with communism. He kind of hastened to add that the idea of a peace dialogue is not to hand over the country to the FARC, it's to reintegrate a sector of society back into, you know, what we know as society here. It's about putting down weapons. It's not about handing it over to a left-wing guerrilla group. But these are the problems. You know, these are the problems. Right. We have to get out there and we have to voice them as journalists here.
Sure. And, it, you know, again, when you're talking about the mainstream press in the international world, you know, you hear about the peace process and then all the different ramifications of that and then on the steps along the way and will it happen, will it not? You know, the handshake, how historic that was and everything. But then, you talk to people here and everyone last year especially was very, very cynical about it all. And then now, I mean, you understand why people are mad. This is going to be an expensive undertaking to reintegrate these people, to just do everything that is required with land reform and everything. And then they watch their minimum wage not go up. And especially in Bogota, which has been so kind of untouched by this war for a long, long time, really now. I mean, there was certain things in the last few years, but you understand why they don't, the war's over to them in many ways in a day-to-day basis. Yeah. So what are we spending all this money for? And I'm not getting any sort of raise, and the exchange rate is terrible,
yeah,
and food prices, inflation are going up. So, yeah. So you're going to spend all this money, you know, conciliatory money, to end this symbolic war. You know,
yeah, it's a really tough one. I mean, because we have to throw our chips in, you know, for peace. I mean, that's the thing. We have to bet on it. But again, like you said, the word you used, ramifications of it. The money needed, the money required, you know, like last year when the Spanish government said that they would give 2 million euros or something, you're like, oh, thanks. You know,
I think the UK just pledged 1.8 million, or I forget the number. The US just pledged a few.
And we're like, this is not going to get us past a few months.
Right.
You know, this is the reality of it. And all of the psychosocial treatment that is required and the, you know, the teaching of just the general population about this, it's just... Yeah, I guess if 100 companies or 100 countries all chip in with the same amount, then that's a different story. We actually have a fund with which to work. But yeah, well, UK 1.8. Yeah, well, that's
That figure may be wrong. I don't know exactly, but
it's not a high one.
Exactly.
I know that.
Yeah.
In truth, in my defense, as a UK citizen, it normally don't send money but expertise in like on the ground. But equally, it doesn't amount to much in the end. But it's really tough in a period where there is no money, you know, in that way, things are becoming tighter economically. And we have to spend, and you know, there has to be an agricultural reform. There has to be. All of Latin America went through this pretty much in the 60s and 70s, some in the 50s, but Colombia never went through it. And this is part of what the continuing problem is. But when you talk about it, the biggest thinker, let's say, in Peru, when the military dictatorship performed the land reform, was 30,000 hectares. And that's a tiny finca on the alongside some of the ones up in Cordoba here, where the smallest one out of a meeting of five people that I was attending at one point was 110,000 meters, you know, hectares. So it's, you know, it's a tough thing. And how do you get people to give up land? You know, how do you repossess it? I don't see it happening, but I have to throw my chips in for peace, you know, I have to. So we're in this situation, you know?
I mean, it is the only, not the only story, but it is the biggest story, and it's the reason everyone's talking about it, but it is, you know, there's just a lot more to it, and there's just a lot more people, in especially in Bogota, that, you know, have varied opinions about it and are
It's a very personal, it's a very personal situation, because everyone here has been affected. You know, you and I, foreigners, we can come and go, and that's the truth of it. We haven't been affected on that level like them. But in terms of the city paper, as we wind down this chat, in terms of the city paper, are you getting pieces ready for post-March 23rd?
A little bit. I mean, it's a little anticlimactic when we've been preparing for it for 6 months, and, you know, something, you know, a handshake's going to happen and some photo ops, and then they're going to say, oh, we actually officially are going to agree to a ceasefire that we've already been doing for months.
Yeah.
So, you know, but, you know, it's a long term. It's a lot of these explainer pieces we'll probably have to do about what is agrarian reform? What, is that, what does that even mean? What is transitional justice all about? You know, these negotiating terms are, you know, it's hard to really explain all the details.
And there hasn't been, you know, a lot, I don't think, out there to explain to the general people. Those who don't want to be informed are not informed, you know. I think those of us who are out there reading everything, you know, can find what we need to read or, you know. But if you're just, you know, interested in your telenovela and, you know, echando pola, you're not going to know anything. You're going to, you will hear, like, the alarmist statements of Fernando Londoño, because that's where they'll reach, you know, the things like, we're giving over to Castro Chavismo, we're going to live, all of our shelves and our supermarkets are going to be empty. But it's not going to happen that way. It's just going to be a long-term process. We're in this for the long run. So anyway, it's been a good chat, I have to say. I don't know. We've got to be upbeat. We've got to be upbeat about it. As you say, anticlimactic 6 months later. Yes, it's true, you know, it's because there's no real surprise, is there?
Yeah, I feel like I'm more positive than some people here because, you know, when I came in 2014 and things were relatively calm compared to when you got here, for instance. So for me, it's not as dangerous. It's not as intractable as perhaps it seemed. And I haven't seen these other peace processes fail and such like that, like on the ground anyways. So I'm very upbeat about it. Yeah. I feel like we're turning a corner.
We are turning a corner. So that's the thing. We are, I think, you know, I was talking to an economist who was the former head of the Bank of Peru many years ago. And he says, you know, what we're entering is a new period of 21st century capitalism, but it will change. It will have a different element to it. And this has to be involved with, you know, the reforms on various levels in Colombia. So if they are actually sort of affected, I think this is a good thing. But if it doesn't happen, then I guess we're more of the same, really. But let's leave it on that note and see what happens on March 23rd and then beyond, of course. Let me take this moment to say thank you to Jared Wade for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure having you here. We've discussed everything from the Indiana Pacers to peace in Colombia. I mean, and an indigenous festival. That's what Colombia Calling is all about. We're trying to cover all the bases here. But anyway, get in touch. As always, you know, that's Colombia Calling Radio at colombiacalling@gmail.com, colombiacallingradio.com, and we're on Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth. I hope you've enjoyed this show. We'll be back next week with another interview talking more Colombia. Thank you again.